First Thessalonians, chapter 5. We're looking at basic Christian relationships in this great text in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. One of the greatest events in the history of the world, and for sure in the history of the church, was the rise of Constantine as emperor over the Roman Empire in the early 4th century, 311, 313. He legalized Christianity, and the persecuted faith, the faith that many slaughtered and sought to destroy, now became legal, and not only legal, it began immediately to come with favor from the government itself. And the leaders of the church, just a few years earlier, slaughtered, dismembered, burned, drowned, many of them with their tongues cut out, their eyes gouged out if they didn't die. Just a few short years later, the leaders of the Christian church, whom the early church from about 125, 150 on called bishops, was now in a position of favor from the emperor himself. Philip Schaff comments on this amazing change. Inconceivable change so suddenly. Through the union of the church with the state, the bishops became at the same time the officials of weight. Enjoyed the various privileges which accrued to the church from this connection. From this point on, they had an independent and legal validity, legal jurisdiction. They held attendance and supervision of the church estates, which were sometimes very considerable. And they had partial charge even of city property. They were exempt from civil jurisdiction, could neither be brought as witness before a court, nor be compelled to take an oath. As their diocese grew larger, their power and their revenues increased. Now there was a man by the name of John Chrysostom. He was a pastor in Antioch, which would be present-day Turkey, and Antioch was one of the great centers of Christianity in the 4th century. It's where Paul, remember, had that church in the 1st century. And it was still a thriving center of Christianity, Antioch, and their pastor was a man named John Chrysostom, known as Golden Mouth. That's what the word Chrysostom means. He was really just John of Antioch, but he was such an orator, they called him Golden Mouth, and that's where we get our English name of his, Chrysostom. Well, Chrysostom commented in 380, just what would that make it, just 60 years later, here's his comments. Kneeling, kissing of the hand, and like tokens of reverence came to them, shown to them by all classes, these are the bishops, up to the emperor himself. The heads of the empire and the governors of provinces enjoy no such honor as the rulers of the church. They are first at court. They are first in the society of ladies, in the houses of the great. No one has precedence over them. We're talking just a few decades, aren't we? The position corresponded to the episcopal insignia. Episcopal is the word for bishop in English, over from the Greek. They had insignia that corresponded now to their position. The ring as the symbol of the espousal of the bishop to the church. That would be the ring that they would kiss, even the emperor. The crook, and then the pallium, a shoulder cloth, a white linen shoulder cloth, after the example of the ephod of the Jewish high priest, and also the sacerdotal mantle worn by the Roman emperors as Pontifex Maximus. You see, the Roman emperors were Pontifex Maximus. They were the highest Maximus priest. Because in the Roman world, there was no separation between religion and the civil state. And so they'd worship the emperor, and they'd worship all these gods. And the highest religious symbol and authority was the emperor himself. So he wore a pallium, which indicated that he was the highest religious official as well as the highest civil official, and his title was Pontifex Maximus, which, by the way, the Roman Pope took his name from. The pallium, this seamless cloth that hung on the shoulders, was of white linen, of white lamb's wool. Now, in the East, that would be Constantinople, Antioch, Jerusalem. In the East, all the bishops wore it, but in the West, which would be Rome, this is the 300s, only the archbishops. And from the 5th century on, it was conferred by the Pope on his ascension, on the bishop's ascension to office. The Pope himself would grant him this pallium, this cloth, to signify his ascension into this office, or his accession to office. At first, the investing of the office was free, but afterwards, the office of bishop and archbishop came to involve a considerable fee. So you had to pay a large fee as well if you were to become a bishop. So Schaff comments, he says this, there were metropolitans, that is, bishops over huge metropolitan areas, especially in Alexandria, Egypt, Constantinople, and Rome, who, while yet hardly past the age of persecution, forgot the servant form of the Son of God and the poverty of his apostles and martyrs, and rivaled the most exalted civil officials, even the emperor himself, in worldly pomp and luxury. No wonder, says Ammianus, that's a secular historian of the 4th century, no wonder Ammianus said that for such a splendid prize as the bishopric of Rome, men strive with the utmost passion and persistence to be the bishop, when rich presents from ladies and a more than imperial sumptuousness invites them. And then he said this. Well, this is another Roman historian, a prefect, Practatius. He declared jestingly to the bishop of Rome at that time, who had obtained the office through a bloody battle, that for such a price, he himself would at once become a Christian. Jerome, right, he died around 409, so you know this is all quick, very quickly. Jerome said of the description of the leaders of the church that they squandered all their care on dress and perfumery, curled their hair with crisping pins, wore sparkling rings, paid far too much attention to women, and looked more like bridegrooms than clergymen. Now, there's a lesson here. This is 60 years, 50, 40, 30 years after. There's an account of the bishops convening at Nicaea in 325 when Constantine himself led them in, some of them still with their scars and a few of them with bandages around their head because their eyes had been gouged out, coming in with Roman pomp and splendor, with purple robes. Now remember, you couldn't wear any clerical garb for 300 years because it would mark you as a target. So it was instant. And it developed in further intensity over a few short decades. It shows you something, doesn't it? Every generation has to guard the gospel, because it can quickly just dissipate. Quickly. Now, we're looking at basic Christian relationships here in 1 Thessalonians 5. Verse 12 and 13 says, but we request of you, brethren, that you appreciate those who diligently labor among you and have charge over you in the Lord and give you instruction, and that you esteem them very highly in love because of their work. Live in peace with one another. So what we have here is basic Christian relationship, and I think Paul tells us there's two basic areas of basic Christian relationships, relating to your leaders, 12 and 13, and then relating to the other members of the body, 14 and 15. Look at 14 and 15. We urge you, brethren, admonish the unruly, encourage the faint-hearted, help the weak, be patient with everyone. See that no one repays another with evil for evil, but always seek after that which is good for one another and for all people. So there you have, relating to all the body, all the brothers and sisters, in verses 14 and 15. In verses 12 and 13, you have relating to the your leaders. And then the rest of the chapter is not basic Christian relationship, it's basic Christian living. So we want to look at recognizing and regarding Christian leaders. That's what we're going to look at this morning. Recognizing those with God-given oversight of your spiritual care. That's what he says. We request of you, brethren, that you appreciate those who diligently labor and have charge over you in the Lord. So we're to recognize those with God-given oversight of your spiritual care. Now, a couple of things to begin with in this regard. This is a practical outworking, I think, of what he said in verse 11 and before. Because he says in 11, therefore encourage one another and build one another up one another just as you are also doing. Build up one another. And so he gives explicit instruction on how to do that as you're waiting the return of Christ in 5, 1 through 11. And he starts with the edification in relationship to leaders and then to each other. We can see in this regard that already it was some kind of a problem at this church. Why else bring it up? The people were struggling already with their leaders. This is not like Corinth. The church isn't about ready to split. But it's an incipient problem, and Paul already sees it. So there's difficulties already here at Thessalonica. There's tension. There's people that are really having trouble following their leaders already. And you can see why on the leader's part, not their part. More than likely, because Paul says in, Luke says about Paul in the early church in Acts 14, they would appoint elders in every city very quickly in Acts 14, 23. So more than likely you had the godly men because Paul wouldn't violate the standards that he himself set up. But though they be godly, they were somewhat immature and inexperienced. They had to be as a whole. To some degree, correct? Had to be. So, their manner, the way they handled people, maybe their personalities, would bother people. They'd get bugged by it. And so, I don't like the way he is. I just don't like the way he is. I don't like his manner. I don't like his personality. He kind of bugs me. And that apparently was going on. They were having difficulty already following their leaders. And, of course, this is a very common issue because it relates to authority and what all of us struggle with, all of us chafe under, all of us find ourselves bristling with is authority. That's a good word, bristle. There's something about someone even thinking they can tell us what to do, let alone try it. And they were bristling, and then on top of it, it's someone that they don't like. Now, there's nothing wrong with this person's character. See, they can't find fault with the character of this person, because he wouldn't be in office. Paul wouldn't tell you to esteem somebody, right? But the issue is pervasive, because even to become a Christian, God has to change your heart in regards to his authority, in regard to recognizing his authority. You have to surrender to his authority. You can't even be saved. You have to become like a little child. And of course, God has delegated authorities. There's spheres of authority. That's just life, you know. You have the government. You have family with the husband. You have civil authorities. You've got city councils. You've got the tax, the revenue authority. It's basically the supreme authority. The return of the emperor himself, unregulated, ungoverned. You have all these authorities. Look at Romans 13. And the Bible indicates that the measure of someone's maturity is how they respond now to authority. Because what you don't do when you're unsaved is regard authority in your heart. You may go through the motions, but you don't regard it in your heart. And then you become a Christian, and you find out my sin was my rebellion against God. I was rebelling against Him and His rightful place over me. We had gone astray, remember, like sheep, and we wouldn't put ourselves under Him. Even though it was a loving authority, we wouldn't put ourselves under Him. And you become a Christian, you find out that as a whole, God doesn't exercise His authority directly. Because you say, well, I could handle it if God came down here and told me Himself. What I don't like is when you tell me. See? Right? And so what He says, in effect, is, no, I don't do any of it directly. I do all of it through delegated authority. And so the measure of whether or not you recognize His authority is whether you recognize those He's placed in authority. And this is where the bristling starts. Because there's deficiencies often in these people. There's personalities. They're just their manner, the way they are. See? But let me show you Romans 13 and show you this is really the case. 13, 1 and 2. Every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities. Now watch this. Why? Because they're really benevolent, kind people. Nero and his lot. Right? Nero and his crowd really are kind at heart. No, for there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. Verse 2, therefore whoever resists authority is opposed to the ordinance of God, and so forth. See, Paul makes it clear that God delegates authority. When you become a Christian, this is one of the marks that you know you've become a Christian. I know now that for me to chafe and bristle and resist and even rebel against some area of authority is really me wrestling and rebelling against God Himself. Whether it's the city council, whether it's taxes, whether it's your husband, whether it's your parents, whether it's the elders, it doesn't matter, whether it's the government. That's why I don't think churches should be known for smearing the government. And so, we are recognized those with God-given oversight. And this is a pervasive issue, it's a problem issue, because Paul doesn't refer to these men, whoever they are, lack character. They simply, whatever, he's inferring that on both sides there's immaturities, and that there's deficiencies in the way these men led, perhaps, because they were new. He doesn't say so, but there's many that think that's very possible. And there's other people that see themselves as more mature, more able, so they bristle under that, they resist it, they fight it. I've seen this for years. They're not able to distinguish between personality and deficiencies of maybe leadership style and the work that they do. See, that's why, if you notice, go back. 1 Thessalonians 5, 13. And that you esteem them very highly in love because they are such easy to get along with, winsome personality types. You esteem them because of their work, because of what they do. You finally have seen the major issue that what they're doing is more significant than some of the irritating ways by which they do it. You see? But they can't see that. That's immaturity. But when you see the significance of the work, which we're all part of, manifesting, exalting Christ to all the peoples for His glory, when you see that, when you see the magnitude of what we're doing, all of a sudden, the fact the man or the group of men is advancing that and exalting Him and doing that, the personality rubs, the deficiencies become less and less and less. Just think about 9/11. Very little concern about deficiencies in manner at 9/11. It's amazing how people got along because they saw the big picture. You see? Giuliani, is that his name? I should know how to say it. It's Italian. He was out the door. He was gone. He was a loser, former mayor in a few months because he lost popularity. He lost support. There were some things that had happened that caused him to nosedive in popularity. All of a sudden, the towers are bombed and he's a hero. Because everyone forgot about personalities and deficiencies, didn't they? You see? He says you esteem them because of the work. You esteem them because of the work. But if you've lost sight of the work, you won't esteem them. That's why one commentator said, spiritual work can only be recognized by a spiritual person. You can only value a man if you value the work the man is doing. You see, if all you measure it by is deficiencies and personalities, you've lost sight of the work. And if you've lost sight of the work, you're not really a spiritual person. You're not seeing the big picture. Now, he's not giving an excuse for scandalous behavior, sinful behavior, wrong behavior, but he's talking simply about all those other small things that people fight over. I've been, the last few years, in contact with so many churches and so many pastors. It's amazing how people, in the eyes, in the mind, in their mind, are standing for a principle when really it's some insignificant, peripheral thing. And a lot of times it's just the pastor or the leader bothers them and bugs them. And they have no sight and they don't place any value on what the man does faithfully. You know, it's funny, I was watching Derek, my little grandboy, the other night. My grandson, he's 4, and his little sister, 2, Brooke. And Brooke's going to take over that house very soon. And so she's chasing Derek around this island in our kitchen. And you can tell he doesn't like it. And she just keeps tracking him. Finally turns around and says, "You're bugging me, Brooke. You're bugging me." Just like that. "You're bugging me, Brooke. You're bugging me." I think that's about what it's like. The preacher's bugging me, man. He's bugging me. You know? "You're bugging me. I don't like your manner." Paul says, esteem them because of the work. See, the magnitude, this is greater than 9/11. I tell these people that maybe have a pastor that labors at preaching and teaching and wants to send missionaries and support men. I said, get the bigger picture. Why are you going to die on that hill and split that church over something like that? You say, "Well, I thought the bathroom should have been red." And he got a crowd together and they painted it white. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that goes on. So, here are the specific duties. That's the practical outworking of edification. Here's the specific duties. 2 things. That you appreciate those in verse 12, and that you esteem them very highly in love in 13. Now, appreciate in the King James was the word know, and I think it's a better translation. I actually think it involves appreciation, but it's more than that. He says, know them, or appreciate them. Realize, in other words, come to an understanding and realize the nature of their work and the value of what they do. Now, the term know is in many places translated simply to see something. It's actually the same word translated when Thomas said, "Except I see his hands and his feet." Now, you can see why it would be connected to that word, because if you see something, you usually understand and perceive when you see it. That's your intent. When I see his hands and his feet, then I'll know and understand that he's raised from the dead. You see this in Galatians, where Peter said, Paul, "But on the contrary, seeing that I had been entrusted with the gospel to the uncircumcision," he says, when the apostles finally saw that, but he means understood, clearly, doesn't he? So the word can mean actually to see, but usually to perceive when you see, to understand. So it has the idea of understanding. Knowing how because of understanding. If a man doesn't know how to manage his house well, That's the word, 1 Timothy 3. With dignity. So what he's saying is tension is relieved by understanding. See, isn't that true in general? When you understand what they do and the nature of what they do, it will relieve the tension that can be created by things that can distract, deficiencies in leaders. And it's like a woman that has some preschoolers and she's just worn out and exhausted and at the end of her rope with energy and frustration and at times with depression and thinking, I've been sentenced to this punishment. And then the husband says, what'd you do all day? He doesn't understand. And it creates tension. It's true of all relationships. Paul says, understand what these men do. Understand the nature of it. That's what he means. It'll relieve the tension. Good understanding, Proverbs says, produces favor. We need to understand it. And that's what he means. Know what they do. And then he says, esteem them very highly. And the meaning of esteem comes from this word, which means to consider or to count something. To consider or to count something. It's used that way often. Consider it all joy, brethren, when you encounter various trials. Consider it. What's that mean? Why? How do you get from consider to esteem? Well, the word basically means that you have a belief resting on your inner thoughts that you arrived at through comparing and weighing facts. It was the deliberate, careful judgment. Think about it. Consider it all joy when you endure various trials, for you will produce patience, and patience will have its perfect works. Think about it. Consider it. So therefore, as a result of considering it, regard it, value it, which would mean esteem it. It says of Moses, he considered, that's the word, the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt. I've thought about it. Remember, he was born in Pharaoh's court. He was high up, heir to the throne. I've thought about it. In comparison, even to the reproach of Christ, the riches of Egypt mean nothing. I thought about it. I esteem my sufferings for Christ higher than any treasure in Egypt, for I'm looking ahead to a greater reward. Wow. So he says, esteem leaders. Esteem them. And what Paul says is this. According to their work. Not according to their winsomeness. We're not talking about their needlessly offensive and needlessly hurt people. You know, a lot of times we're just, there's deficiencies in all of us where we're not aware what we said might have hurt someone. But he's not talking about an aggressive, mean-spirited thing. Esteem them because of their work. Have a common purpose, as he would say in 1 Corinthians 1 and Philippians 1. Have a common purpose, a common mind. Your partners in the gospel. Is the gospel being gotten out? Is the word being preached? Are disciples being made? See, is the glory of Christ spreading around the world? Or even in your town? Look at Philippians, how Paul actually gave us an illustration of this in his own ministry. He gave us a good illustration of this in his own ministry. Remember chapter 1 when he was in jail? Remember, he was in prison. He was in jail. And people tried to hurt him while he was in jail. Think about that. It's bad enough somebody trying to hurt you, right? But when you're in bad times and they want to hurt you, it's even worse. But that's how jealous these people were. Notice. 13. So that my imprisonment in the cause of Christ has become well known throughout the whole Praetorium Guard and everyone else. 1:13. And that most of the brethren trusting in the Lord because of my imprisonment have far more courage to speak the word of God without fear. Now watch this. Some, to be sure, are preaching Christ even from envy and strife. They were jealous of Paul. They were envious of his great favor with so many people and so many churches, and his reputation in circles of many of the churches was so high, and they didn't have it. They didn't have that reputation. They didn't have that favor. So they continued to preach that now that he was in jail, but to try to undo his favor and gain more favor for themselves, since he was locked up and couldn't preach as much, right? And they thought, well, maybe I can catch up to Paul while he's in jail. Amazing. They preached out of envy. The latter do it out of love. In 16, knowing that I'm appointed for the defense of the gospel. The former proclaim Christ in 17 out of selfish ambition rather than pure motives, thinking to cause me distress in my imprisonment. What then? What do you want? What do you think I'm going to say about this? He goes, what does this all mean to me? What then? Here's what it means to me. Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is proclaimed, and in this I rejoice. And then he adds, and yes, I will rejoice. Christ is proclaimed. There's something bigger than me. There's something more important than me. There's something more significant than me. And it's his glory and his name. Then he goes on to say, whether in my body, whether it be by death or by life, Christ will be exalted. That's what beats out of us this petty way of looking at things. Somebody asked me the other day, how do you get unity in a church? Two things, doctrine and devotion. I can prove it to you. I'm not going to turn there. Till we all come to the unity of the faith, Ephesians 4. You got to have a common regard for truths that you feel you'll die for them. The unity of the faith, and then a common devotion. One purpose, one mind, that his glory will be exalted, whether in your body, whether life or death, he's exalted. That we're throwaway commodities. He doesn't even need us. It's a great privilege to be a part of this church on any level, because it's a great privilege to serve him on any level, because he can just throw us away. He told that crowd, he said, when they were worshiping him and giving him hosannas, they said, make these people quiet. He says, I can make the stones say it. You understand this? We're not as important as we think we are. Greatly loved, for sure. So people move from church to church. They're trying to find somebody that just doesn't bug them. You know what I mean? I got to find somebody that doesn't bug me. Because you're bugging me, man. You know? So they go from church to church. The greatest rate of divorce is not first-time marriages. It's second-time marriages. That's right. Second-time marriages, the divorce rate is over 60%. It's higher. Because here's what happens. The first time they say, you know, I just got a bad apple. I'm going to go get me a good apple. And you go out there and you find out, another bad apple. It's like Liz Taylor used to say after eighth marriage, it's hard to find a good man. That's what she said. Eighth or ninth. She says, you know, it's awful hard to find a good man these days. It ain't me. It's not me. You see, it can't be me. That's what the people never think about it. You say, the reason you're so irritated is you're irritable. You're too irritable. So he says, esteem them. Appreciate them for their work. And that we all together are in a partnership in the gospel. And of course, as I've said, he's not talking about character issues. He's not talking about sin and leadership or laziness. He's talking about men that basically carry out the ministry. Oh, how deadly this is. So, we see the specific duties are to know them, and which is to appreciate them and to recognize them. And then, thirdly, regarding this recognition, because we're just talking at the recognition of these elders, we looked at the practical outworking on it, then the specific duties, and now the men in the ministry worthy of our regard. Who are the men, and what is the ministry worthy of our respect and regard? Well, let's look. 1 Thessalonians. He says, first of all, brethren, that you appreciate those who diligently labor amongst you. So they're those that labor. And of course, the word labor is a specific term that means, the root word means to beat on something, to smite on something. It meant to beat on the breast in grief. And then it came to mean anything you beat that causes difficulty or labor. So it meant intense labor, united with trouble and toil. They are those that labor. They are those that labor and don't turn away from the labor if it brings them trouble and toil. In fact, it means to labor and come to the point where you're weary, you're tired and exhausted. And yet they don't shrink back from it. Jesus said, come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden. That's the identical word, weary there. You've labored and your soul's weary. Come to me, all of you who are weary. I will give you rest. You've worked and toiled without me. You've gone through life without me. And all it's brought you is weariness. That's what he's saying. It's amazing. Come to me, all you are weary in your soul. You weary in your soul? You're labored. Your tongue's hanging out if we could look at your soul. That's why he likens coming to him to drinking living waters by which you'll never thirst again. Come to me, I'll give you rest for your soul. It's the same word. Look at chapter 1, verse 3. We can see how this thing works. You know, we hear of someone say, she has a mother's love. You've heard that illustrated that way. She has a mother's love. And you say, you know what you mean. Her love labors. She has a mother's love. Her love labors, and she doesn't quit because of her love. She's tired. She gets up late, but she loves her child. She loves her child. And oh, there's nothing like a mother's love. Oh. That's why you hear these athletes interviewed, and sometimes you think they don't even have dads. And sometimes they don't, but many times they do. But it's that mother's love. Because it labors. It can't be inconvenienced enough. And God uses this of himself about us. Look at how he says it in verse 3. Constantly bearing in mind in verse 3 of chapter 1, your work of faith and notice, and your labor of love and steadfastness of hope. Labor that comes out of love. These are men who labor. They'll be inconvenienced. They'll work long hours. They'll do tiresome labor, and it's because there's some kind of love producing it. It says they must be men in 1 Timothy 5 who labor in the word and doctrine, in preaching and doctrine. They must be men known primarily for that. Let me say something here on behalf of the staff of our church. There's 6 pastors in our church, and others are elders, but 6 pastors and dear friends, none of them does a 40-hour week. Not even close. Not even close. Doesn't even get near it. Did you ever think about it? If we're down here 4 days, 8 hours, we go home and teach. If I'm in the school of theology or Phil or somebody's teaching there, I leave at 6 and get back at 10:30. And then there's Bible study for every year we've been here from 6:45 till 9:30. And then there's Sundays where you get up at 5:30 in the morning. That's when you get up. You make sure everything's in order and fitted and ready to go. And then you preach and you go home at 8 and you go home at 1. You go take a nap at 3:30 and you get up because there's a night service. And sometimes there's interviews all day if there's a baptism. Or if there's a wedding, it's a Saturday gone. It's a labor of love, but it's a Saturday gone, friends. You're not with your family. It's a labor of love. And there's no way that any of these men work even a 50-hour week. And then you get home Sunday and you're home at 8:30 And sometimes, and it's all joyful, friends. It's all delightful, but it's labor. And you go to bed and you just crash after you watch Sports Final. You got to watch Sports Final. Watch those 1 in 10 Niners. And you crash. And it's joyful, it's delightful. Because there's nothing more significant. It's amazing how people say, what do you do? And I say, well, I golf a lot. See, you need to know what the men do. That's why I can't wait. Somebody said, boy, you sure seem to race out of here on vacation. I said, you better believe it. I'll race out of here. No forwarding telephone number. Even Jesus said, get aside and what? Rest. He says there are those who labor. And there are those who have oversight. He also says they have oversight in verse 13 or 12. They diligently labor among you and have charge over you in the Lord and give you instruction. They have charge over you. Now this specific word, it's used in Timothy of managing your house, the identical word. A prospective elder must be one who manages his household well, keeping his children under control with all dignity. It's the same word there as manage. It means to oversee. It's used of protection, to give aid and to care for and to give attention to. For it says, give attention to good works. Titus, to maintain them. Give attention to it. Take note of that your life is characterized by these things. So it's a person who gives attention to others, to care, to oversee, and does it not as a dominator, but as someone who, with his children, for example, do it with all dignity. So it's to oversee their well-being, to oversee their spiritual souls and their condition. He says, and also those who admonish. They're willing to tell you where you've gone amiss, and put it to your mind. Now, I'd like you to turn to Matthew 9. This will be our closing text. Matthew 9. What should you do in response to God's admonition for you and I to regard the men who we have leadership over us, wherever they be? He says in chapter 9, I'll read this and we'll comment. Seeing the people in verse 36, seeing the people, he felt compassion for them because they were distressed and dispirited like sheep without a shepherd. He connects their distression and their dispiritedness, which in the King James is downcast, which I think is even a better translation. They're fine. Downcast because they're without a shepherd. Then he said to the disciples, the harvest is plentiful, the workers are few. Beseech the Lord of the harvest, therefore, to send out workers into his harvest. Ask him. How should we respond? First of all, receive God's care for you through the instrumentality of the oversight of those he's appointed. You see, he doesn't do it directly. He doesn't send Michael or Gabriel. He puts men, fallen men, men who are clay jars, clay pots, over us. You just simply aren't going to find somebody that at some point doesn't manifest some deficiency. I remember when it first dawned on me, my pastor wasn't perfect. God bless that brother. I worked with him for 9 years, 4 times as a full-time associate. But I'd tell myself, I love his heart for the gospel. I love the way he preaches fearlessly. I love the way he wants to make disciples. I love the way he doesn't cater to men. I love this man. That stuff is just too small for me to bother him all the time. And maybe once in 9 years I ever talked to him. Because I knew that God gave me care through the instrumentality of another. I never had it, friends. Realize that the measure of maturity is your response to leadership clearly in Scripture? And how you respond to their deficiencies, whether they be real or perceived. Because often they're just perceived, but that doesn't matter because in your mind they're real. In your mind they're real. So the measure of where we are with the Lord and our growth is whether or not we keep the main things the main thing. Because it's immaturity to focus on something that's not the main thing. And this doesn't mean that leaders shouldn't be admonished or confronted. I'm not saying that at all. They're not above that. But lastly, remember the great, great blessing of care and oversight, even if it's imperfect. Jesus said, these people are distressed and they're downcast. What vivid terms. The first term, they're both in a perfect tense, which means they remain in this state and they can't extract themselves from it. They continually are distressed. They are continually downcast. They can't get themselves out of the mire because they're people without a shepherd. They travel through the howling wilderness of life without a shepherd. Oh, I thank God He saved me in my 20s. But it doesn't matter when He saves you. You then take on board a pilot in a raging sea, as it were, and a guide in a howling desert. Otherwise, you'll be distressed and downcast, which means the first word, distress, means flayed, lacerated. The word meant to cut and lacerate. But He likens what life does to people, paralleling it to the skin being lacerated and flayed. He says, otherwise, if someone could look inside of you, you'd be like a body scarred with lacerations because you don't have a shepherd. Amazing. You don't have a shepherd. That is your problem. That is all your problem. That's the problem. You're a sheep without a shepherd in a howling desert. Downcast means, and it's the word ripto. I mean, you can even hear our word riptide there. It means cast and hurled down. It was used of the coins thrown down by Judas in the temple. You're like someone thrown down and hurled to the earth. And you have all the destruction, all the bruises all over you from it. And it's not going to get any better. It's only going to get worse. Until you have a shepherd. And God gives men who fallibly attempt to reflect the shepherd. You're not going to be an orphan anymore. Have you come to Christ and repented of your sin? Have you really said, God, I'm evil and wicked and I've done sinful, horrible things? Wash away all the blood with the blood. Wash it all away. I want Jesus as my Savior and my Shepherd. I don't want to walk another step through this barren, desolate, howling wilderness. Let's pray.